previously on Unsolved.
Two boys taking a shortcut through Whitnall Park find John Zira, nude, face down in the rocks and mud. Police will say he's been molested and then bludgeoned, perhaps with a large rock.
You know, maybe the police knew from the get-go what they were doing, but I got the impression, I was only 14 or 15 at the time, that they were making it up as they went along.
I think the thing that struck me the most when I started working on this case was, number one, just how complicated it must have been to try to solve a crime like this back in the 1970s. They didn't have computers where they could scan in all their files. They didn't have email. They didn't have texting. They didn't have cell phones. They didn't have faxes even back then. So they had five different agencies trying to keep track of all this information, and it was not easy to do. From the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, this is Unsolved, a murdered teen, a 40-year mystery. I'm Gina Barton. How has the cold case murder of John Zira remained unsolved for so long? It starts with a series of mistakes, some more serious than others. 14-year-old John Zira disappeared from Franklin High School on February 20th, 1976. His body was found 8 days later. And 40 years after the crime, the killer's identity remains unknown. In this episode, we'll explore the mistakes that were made early in the investigation and how those errors still affect the case today. Jurisdiction in this murder was really complicated. First, you had Franklin, because John's family lived in Franklin, and he was a freshman student at Franklin High School. So they were in charge of the missing persons investigation, which lasted the 8 days. And then when John's body was found in the park, it was actually found in a part of the park that was on the Hills Corner side, not the Franklin side. And so jurisdiction is usually determined by the place where the crime was committed. So they believe that the crime of the murder actually happened in the park right where the body was, which was Hales Corners. Here's some audio about jurisdiction in the case. This audio also comes from the 1978 WTMJ TV report on the John Zira investigation. You'll hear various clips of that report throughout today's episode.
Hales Corners, the smallest police force in suburban Milwaukee, just 13 men, had complete jurisdiction in the John Zira case. Detective Sergeant Howard Hingis was in charge.
Detective Howard Hingis had joined the police force back in 1958. And when I asked him about why he joined the police force, he basically said because he liked to be outside. And I also talked to him about this, you know, Hell's Corners, then or now, was not really the murder capital of Wisconsin. And so at the time, since he had been on the force 20 years, he had investigated one murder before John. And in that case, a pharmacist called the police station and said he had just killed his wife and was waiting at the door when Hingis got there. So it was completely different. He didn't have very much experience at all, and really neither did anybody else in the department. In our last episode, we introduced now-retired officer Gary Lindenlob. He was one of the first officers to arrive at Whitnall Park after John's body was found. Here's what Lindenlob had to say about the training back then.
At that time, I had my two-year degree. Hadn't been to training academy yet. Started June 1st. I was with an officer for 3 days, and then I was on my own, which nowadays would never happen. I can remember a couple of cases where you'd find all these cigarette butts around. If you had multiple agencies coming in, you'd find all these cigarette butts around. It's like, you realize where they're from. They're actually from the officers. They're not, you know, it makes it real hard to collect evidence when you're picking up some officer's cigarette butt instead of the suspect's cigarette butt.
For the police, the challenges of the case far outstripped their abilities, their training, and the technology that was available at that time. Basically, this investigation was baffling from the beginning. A kid disappears from school right after lunch and is gone for 8 days, and then they find him dead in the park. They didn't know how he had gotten from school to the park. They didn't know if he went voluntarily or if someone abducted him. They didn't know who he went with. They couldn't even really figure out when he had been last seen at school. And there were people who had seen things kind of in and around the park, but they weren't sure if they were related to the crime. So it was just a huge needle in a haystack situation from the beginning. Howard Hingis is retired now. I met him at a restaurant to talk about the Zara case.
You know, I feel sorry for the family. He was a boy, you know, I think he was 14.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, all of a sudden, during the school, he's gone.
And it kind of seems like, from the beginning, there wasn't much to go on.
No. There was very little to go on.
They needed help. They had the State Department of Justice brought in the crime lab people, and they also brought in an investigator. And then they also asked for help from the FBI. So an FBI agent developed a profile for who they thought killed John. There was just one problem. This was back when profiling was in its infancy. I talked to former Milwaukee FBI agent Neil Pertell. He helped actually develop profiling, but he didn't work on this case. He said profiling has evolved a lot since the 1970s, and he gave me some insight into how it works.
Based upon your education and your life experience, you will do things differently than someone who has a different life experience and particularly education, social skills. And those things are evident at a crime scene. The things we look at is victim selection, neighborhood, planning, evidence of planning, pre-planning, planning for what to do after the crime is committed, staging, is the victim moved, efforts to control, all these things are visible if you look for them at a crime, particularly crimes with interpersonal relationships where a person has had physical contact with a victim, an assault, rape, murder. The decisions that a person makes before, during, and after are the things that a profiler looks at.
And the investigation hit a bit of a snag here. The FBI told Hingis to keep the sexual assault out of the media so as not to make the perpetrator mad. But the word got out, and it was a mess.
It was decided to keep evidence of a sexual assault secret, perhaps to use against a future suspect. But somebody released the information to the press anyway. Then, too late, the statement was retracted. Finally, sufficiently confused, the issue was dropped. In fact, John Zira was molested.
Back then, homosexuality was much more stigmatized than it is now. And I actually think that maybe that hurt the investigation more than it helped, because then Hingis and the people who were working with him, one of the first things they asked everybody is, you know, who do you know that's gay? And I don't think that's really a good indication of who the killer would be.
The leads were all circumstantial. At first, the homosexual angle was pursued. For instance, they spent a great deal of time trying to decide if the Zira boy had a homosexual background. None was found.
Hingis used the profile to narrow down the list of suspects to one man, a construction worker who was part of the crew working on an addition to Franklin High School. So this construction worker was suspected by the police because he was friendly with some of the students. He would have lunch with them sometimes. And there were some rumors floating around that he may have sold marijuana to the students. Now, when I talked to him, he said the students were selling marijuana to him. But in any case, he was pretty friendly with a lot of the students. And there were rumors going around that he and another guy were either gay or bisexual and having a romantic relationship. And so immediately, they popped up on Hingis's radar because he was looking for a gay or bisexual man. For a while, he had no alibi at all, which was one of the reasons why they kept him at the top of the suspect list. But he wanted to prove his innocence, so he agreed to take a lie detector test. So back in the 1970s, polygraphs were this brand new toy for law enforcement. And people really believed that they could prove whether someone was lying or telling the truth. They could use them in court, which they can't do anymore now. And so I think I lost track, but it was at least 10 or 12 different people they subjected to lie detector tests. And it seemed like in most of the cases, if you passed a lie detector test, you were just off the suspect list. And if you failed one, they were going to, you know, stick to you like glue until they could prove the case against you. And that's really different from how polygraphs are used today. Today, investigators look at them as a useful tool for investigation, but more telling than the results of the test itself are the person's willingness or not to take one. The construction worker passed the polygraph, but one of his friends said he told her he'd beaten the machine. She also said his heavy drug use was affecting his mental health. Here's the woman talking to WTMJ-TV reporter Pete Wilson about the construction worker's lie detector test.
He passed it.
Did he talk to you about passing it?
Yes, he came to my house the night he took the test. And he told me that he passed it. But then after a while, he started going into his other personalities. And he said they had the best producer, the best equipment, and the best cops. And I fooled them all.
So when I talked to the construction worker, he disputed all of this. He said he never told the woman any of those things, and he said the police reports about him were all wrong. In any case, from the police point of view, there were a couple of reasons this construction worker stayed on the suspect list, even though he passed the lie detector. The woman's statement was one. The fact that he didn't have an alibi was another. Finally, he says he got a bill from his doctor. And he kind of went, oh, that's why I wasn't at work that day. I was at the doctor's office. And so the police then did go back and check with the doctor. And he had an appointment, I believe, at 3:15 that day. And so it seemed pretty clear to me then that he couldn't have done it because they put the time of death for John at between about 1 and 2. So, and the doctor said, you know, he wasn't nervous, he didn't have blood on his clothes, he wasn't late for his appointment, he wasn't acting weird. So at that point, although it would have been possible for somebody to commit a crime in that kind of small window, it was probably really unlikely. Well, back in 1978, 2 years after John's body was found, his family was incredibly frustrated. They just thought that Hingis wasn't doing what he was supposed to do. They thought that, you know, so much time had gone by, this case should have been solved by now. John's dad didn't want to talk with me about the case. But here's what he told WTMJ-TV back in 1978.
Well, I'm just totally resentful of everything, of our police system. I have no faith at all in them. I don't think I'm getting any help from anybody. Why should I have to hire an attorney to get all this stuff when it's my right to have this investigated?
They hired then-attorney Alan Eisenberg, who is another really interesting character. He didn't make it into the print version of the story very much, but he was known for basically going around town in a red fedora. And he had a really colorful personality also. He once demanded that his client, who was a dog that officials wanted to destroy for biting somebody, he wanted that dog to be tried by a jury of its peers, meaning 12 dogs. So he was a really interesting guy. And so back then, John's family hired him to try and get a John Doe investigation open and figure out, like, why wasn't this case being solved? What could be done? Eisenberg would uncover some rather unflattering news about Hingis. When Eisenberg talked to the construction worker's friend, she said she and Hingis were sleeping together. Understandably, retired Detective Hingis didn't want to talk too much about his indiscretion with one of the witnesses back in the day. He's still married to the same woman he was married to at the time. But he has always contended that really that had nothing to do with the investigation. And in fact, when the police department did their internal investigation, they concluded that it didn't impact his work on the case. So it was definitely an unfortunate situation. And it was just one of the crazy things that happened in this case that, you know, doesn't happen in cases you see every day. But he didn't want to talk too much about it. All he would say is that it was a bad time in his life. 2 years after John's death, his family doesn't have any answers. The first detective who was assigned to the case, Howard Hingis of the Hales Corners Police Department, didn't have what we would consider adequate training today. The FBI tells him to look for a homosexual or bisexual man, and he zones in on one suspect, a construction worker. And then Hingis has an affair with a woman close to that suspect and gets suspended for 60 days. John's family was left without any answers. Here's audio from Janice Zara, John's mom.
I never had an idea that, you know, the police were like Starsky and Hutch. I never had that idea. I was never that naive. But I can't believe the follow-ups.
Next time on Unsolved, Dan Acker was a swim coach in a couple of rec departments, and he also had worked at the mental health complex. And the police had talked to him back in the 70s about John, because the day after John's body was found, he was found standing near the crime scene in the park.
He better related to early teens and boys. He was into models. He was into things that kids of that age would have been into.
Detective Schoonover's reaction at first was, yeah, they talked to this guy back in the 70s. He's not the guy. He didn't do it. Whatever. This weirdo again. But the more information he got and the more that he looked into some of the other things that had happened, he started to think like, oh, maybe this could be the guy after all. And maybe, you know, they missed somebody who was right in front of their faces back then. Unsolved is produced by Katie O'Connell and narrated by me, Gina Barton, reporter for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. The project was edited by Greg Borowski, with web design by Aaron Coy, graphics by Lou Saldivar, and video by Bill Schultz. You can find more online at jsonline.com/unsolved.